Of course, when one comes to think of it. Father shot a look at him, and he went on quickly. Certain unique books seem to be without forerunners or successors as far as their authors are concerned. Even though they may profoundly influence the work of other writers, for their creator they're complete, not leading anywhere. Topaz was watching Father as anxiously as I was. "Oh, but surely," she began protestingly. Father interrupted her. "Do you mean that the writers of such books are often one-book men?" he asked very quietly. "Heaven forbid," said Simon Cotton. "I only mean that I was wrong to use the word successor. The originators among writers, perhaps, in a sense, the only true creators, dip deep and bring up one perfect work. Complete, not a link in a chain. Later, they dip again for something as unique. God may have created other worlds, but he obviously didn't go on adding to this one." He said it in a rather stately, literary way, but quite sincerely. And yet I didn't feel it was sincere. And I didn't feel it meant very much. I think it was really a kind and clever way of sliding over a difficult moment. Though, if so, he must have been very quick to realize how difficult the moment was. The odd thing was that Father seemed so impressed. He jerked his head as if some idea had just struck him, but he didn't answer. It was as if he wanted to think for a minute. Then Simon Cotton asked him a question about the third dream and Jacob wrestling, and he came to life again. I haven't seen him so alive since the year he married Topaz. And he didn't talk only about himself. After he had answered the questions, he drew us all in, particularly Rose. He kept saying things which made the Cottons turn to her, which they seemed very glad to do. Neil Cotton didn't talk as much as his brother. Most of the time he sat on the copper with Heloise. He winked at me once in a friendly way. At last Thomas came in to say the horses were waiting. There was enough cocoa left for him, but none for Stephen, who had stayed with the horses. Luckily, I had saved half mine and put it by the fire to keep warm. Father and I sloshed down the lane with the Cottons to see the car hauled out. Rose couldn't come because of her tea gown, and Topaz didn't seem to want to. There was much pleasant confusion, with the Cottons flashing torches and everyone laughing and making the noises horses expect, and then the car was safely on the road again. After that, the goodbyes were rather hurried, but both the Cottons said that they would see us again soon, and I am sure that they meant it. Stephen and Thomas took the horses back, and Father and I trudged home in the rain. The boys took the lantern, so it was very dark. I need hardly say that our family hasn't possessed a working torch for years. Father held my arm firmly and seemed wonderfully cheerful. I asked him what he thought of the Cottons, and he said, "Well, I shouldn't think they're dunners for the rent." Then he said he had forgotten how stimulating Americans could be, and told me interesting bits about his American lecture tours. And he said Simon Cotton was the Henry James type of American, who falls in love with England. He'll make an admirable owner for Scotney. The only Henry James novel I ever tried to read was What Maisie Knew, when I was about 9. I expected it to be a book for children. We had a beautiful plum-coloured edition of James's works then. But of course it got sold with the other valuable books. As soon as we got back to the castle, Father went up to the gatehouse room and I rushed to join the girls. They were talking excitedly. Topaz had got over her quiet mood. She was sure Rose had made a hit and started to plan how to alter a dress for her, a real London dress that Rose has always admired. And they decided about cleaning the drawing room in case the Cottons called very soon. I said, wasn't it wonderful that Father actually seemed to like them? Through the back windows of the gatehouse, we could see him sitting at his desk. Topaz said, "It's happened. The miracle. He's going to start work again." Stephen and Thomas came back, and I made Stephen drink the cocoa I'd saved for him. I had to hold it ready to pour down the sink before he would take it. Then we went to bed. Rose got all her clothes out and draped them over Miss Blossom to see if any of them were better than she remembered. They were worse. But even that didn't depress her. We talked and talked. Suddenly I sat up in bed and said, "Rose, we're working it up too much. We mustn't. Of course, it'll be wonderful if we're asked to parties and things, but, Rose, You couldn't marry that man with a beard. I could marry the devil himself if he had some money, said Rose. I am pretty sure she was remembering Simon Cotton's shadow, but as she didn't mention it, I didn't. There is no point in working up a thing like that about a wealthy man. After we'd blown the candles out, I made Miss Blossom talk. I can never think of the sort of things she says unless I pretend she is really saying them. When I asked her what she thought about it all, she answered, "Well, it's a start, girl is. There's no denying that. Now you just make the best of yourselves. Of course, all these old clothes you've draped over me won't help you much. But wash your hair and keep your hands nice. That green stuff on them's funny for once, but the joke's over. And now you'd better think of your complexions and get some beauty sleep." Rose certainly took the hint about the dye. This morning she scrubbed and scrubbed her hands until she got it all off. She used our last grains of scouring powder, so my dye will just have to wear off. It has now reached a grey stage which looks like dirt. Oh, I have just had an idea. After tea, I shall attack myself with sandpaper. How quickly life can change. This time yesterday it was a wintry blank. And now, not only have we met the Cottons, but there is a real hint of spring. From up here in the barn I can see blackthorn buds on the hedges. I have just discovered that by moving my head I can make the square opening near the roof frame different parts of the lane. It is a rather fascinating game. Oh. Oh, my goodness. They're here. The Cottons. They've just come round the last bend of the lane. Oh. What am I to do? They have gone past. There was no way I could warn Rose and Topaz. I couldn't have got out of the barn without being seen. At least I know they are back from their walk because I heard Rose playing the piano some time ago. But how will they be dressed? And heavens, Rose was thinking of washing her hair. Never did we dare to hope the Cottons would come this very day. I watched them pass through the hinge of a barn door, then scrambled up on the chaff again and watched until they disappeared into the gatehouse passage. Ought I to go in? I want to, of course, but there is a huge hole in my stocking and my gym dress is all dusty from the chaff. It must be half an hour since I wrote that last line. I didn't go in. I have been lying here on the chaff, thinking of them in the drawing room with the log fire burning. It won't really matter if Rose did wash her hair, because it looks very beautiful when it is drying. I feel sure I did right to stay here. For one thing, I talk too much sometimes. I must be desperately careful never to distract attention from Rose. I keep telling myself it is real. It really has happened. We know two men. And they like us. They must. Or they wouldn't have come back so soon. I don't really want to write any more. I just want to lie here and think. But there is something I want to capture. It has to do with the feeling I had when I watched the Cottons coming down the lane. The queer, separate feeling. I like seeing people when they can't see me. I've often looked at our family through lighted windows and they seem quite different. A bit the way rooms seen in looking glasses do. I can't get the feeling into words. It slipped away when I tried to capture it. Simon Cotton's black beard looks queerer than ever by daylight, especially now I've realised he isn't at all old. I should guess him to be under 30. He has nice teeth and a rather nice mouth with a lot of shape to it. It has a peculiar naked look in the midst of all that hair. How can a young man like to wear a beard? I wonder if he has a scar. His eyebrows go up at the corners. Neil Cotton has such a charming face, though no particular feature is striking. Very nice hair, fairish, curly. He looks very healthy. Simon is a bit pale. They're both tall. Simon a bit the taller. Neil a bit the broader. They don't look like brothers any more than they sounded. Simon is wearing tweeds, very English-looking. Neil is wearing a coat such as I never saw in my life before. Checked, back and front, but plain sleeves. Perhaps it was made out of two old coats, though I hope not, as that would show him to be poor and his brother mean. And it looked rather a noisily new coat. I expect it's just American. They're coming out of the castle. Shall I run to meet them and just shake hands? No, not with these grey hands. Something awful has happened. So awful that I can hardly bear to write it. Oh, how could they? How could they? As they came towards the barn, I heard them talking. Neil said, "Gosh, Simon, you're lucky to get away with your life." "Extraordinary, wasn't it?" said Simon. "She didn't give that impression at all last night." Then he turned to look back at the castle and said, "What a wonderful place, but hellish uncomfortable. And they obviously haven't a cent. I suppose one can't blame the poor girl." "One can blame her for being so darned obvious," said Neil. "And that ridiculous dress at this time of the day. Funny, I rather liked her in it last night." "The stepmother seems quite pleasant. She looked about as uncomfortable as I felt. My God, how that girl embarrassed me." "We shall have to drop them, Simon. If we don't, she may put you in a very awkward position." Simon said he supposed so. They were talking quietly, but it was so still that every word came to me clearly. As they passed the barn, Neil said, "Pity we didn't see the child again. She was a cute kid." "A bit consciously naive, don't you think?" said Simon. "I shall feel worst about dropping the old man. I'd rather hoped I could help him, but I don't suppose there's much one can do if he's a hopeless drunk. Oh, I could kill them. When Father doesn't even get enough to eat, let alone any strong drink. They must have heard some lying gossip. How dare people say he drinks? And he isn't an old man. He's not yet 50. I didn't hear any more. I wish now that I had rushed out and hit them. That would have shown them if I am consciously naive. What on earth did Rose do? I must go in. 8 o'clock, in the drawing room. I've come in here to get away from Rose. She is drying her hair in the kitchen and manicuring her nails with a sharpened match. And she is talking, talking. I don't know how Topaz can stand it, knowing what she does know, for I couldn't keep it to myself. I couldn't bear to. I might have done if I hadn't found her alone when I got in. But I did, and she saw that I was upset. I began to tell her in a whisper. Ours is a dreadful house for being overheard in. But she said, "Wait," and pulled me out into the garden. We could hear Rose singing upstairs, so we didn't talk until we had crossed the bridge and gone a little way up the mound. Topaz wasn't as furious as I had expected, but of course I didn't tell her the bit about Father. She wasn't even surprised. She said Rose had seen the Cottons coming from her bedroom window, and nothing would stop her changing into the tea gown. As if anyone ever wore a tea gown for tea. And she had behaved insanely, making a dead set at Simon Cotton. "Do you mean she was too nice to him?" "Not exactly. That mightn't have mattered so much. She was terribly affected. She kept challenging him. If she'd had a fan, she'd have tapped him with it and said, 'Fie, fie,' and she fluttered her eyelids. It had all have been very fetching 100 years ago." "Oh, I could see it. Rose got it out of old books. We've never known any modern women except Topaz, and Rose would never dream of copying her." "Oh, poor, poor Rose. She never even saw modern girls on the pictures, as I did." "They won't come back," said Topaz. "I'd have known that even if you hadn't overheard what they said. I said we didn't want them, that they must be hateful people to talk like that. But Topaz said that was nonsense. Rose asked for it. Men don't really mind your showing you like them when you do, but they run a mile from obvious fascination. That's what it was, of course, all the challenging and head-tossing, and all directed at Simon in the crudest way. If Mortmain had been in, he might have chaffed her out of it. Anyway, he'd have talked to them himself. Oh, blast! Father had gone for a walk, the first he has taken for months. Topaz said Simon Cotton had brought him a book by a famous American critic because one of the essays in it dealt with Jacob Wrestling. "I suppose Simon just might come back to talk to Mortmain," she said. But I knew better. It was beginning to get dark. There was a light down in the kitchen. We saw Rose pass the window. Should we tell her? I said. Topaz thought not. Unless we ever get asked to Scotney. If we do, we might try to kick some sense into her. We won't get asked. Topaz put her arm round me, and we trudged down the mound, very awkwardly, because she takes longer strides than I can. When we got to the bottom, she looked back at Belmont Tower, dark against the twilight sky. Beautiful, isn't it? She said in her most velvety tones. Now, could she really be interested in beauty at such a moment? Incidentally, when she painted the tower, she made it look like a black rolling pin on an overturned green pudding basin. My candle is burning out, and the drawing room is getting colder and colder. The fire has been out for hours. But I can't write this in the same room with Rose. When I look at her, I feel I'm watching a rat in a trap that hopes it will get out when I know it won't. Not that I ever watched a rat in a trap, nor does Rose think she is one. But this is no moment to be finicky about metaphors. Heloise has just pushed the door open and come in and licked me, which is kind but so chilly as I dry. And I can now hear what is going on in the kitchen far more fully than I could wish. Father is there now and is talking excitedly. He says the American critic has discovered things in Jacob Wrestling that he certainly never put there, and that the arrogance of critics is beyond belief. He is obviously enjoying the thought of discussing it all with Simon Cotton. Rose's exuberance has risen higher and higher. I regret to say that she is now whistling. Stephen has been in and put his coat round me. It smells of horses. Am I consciously naive? Perhaps I am. Perhaps this journal is. In future, I will write it in stark prose. But I won't really write it at all anymore, because I have come to the end of this exercise book. I have already used both inside covers, and am now crossing my writing. And crossed speed writing will probably never come uncrossed. It must be just 24 hours since those cottons walked in on me in my bath. Topaz has just yelled that she's making cocoa. Oh, comfortable cocoa. Not so good. Topaz has now yelled that it will have to be made with water because the cottons drank the milk. There was no tea to offer them. Still, any kind of cocoa is good. But it will be agony to know that Rose will think we are having it to celebrate. While Topaz and I know that it is funeral baked meats. The end. Slam the book shut. Book 2. The Shilling Book. April and May. Chapter 6. I have a new exercise book, the finest I ever saw. It cost a whole shilling. Stephen got Miss Marcy to buy it in London last week. She went up on a cheap day ticket. When he gave it to me, I thought I would write something like Wuthering Heights in it. I never dreamt that I should want to go on with this journal. And now life has begun all over again. I'm up on Belmont. Spring has come with such a bound that catkins are still dangling on the hazels, while daisies are rushing out on the mound. I particularly love them in the short, brilliant grass of the Mott, where they look like spring in a child's picture book, as well as the real spring. There are daffodils down in the courtyard garden, but I can't see them from here because the washing is flapping. Topaz keeps coming out with more and more things to peg up, and they're all part of the exciting happenings. I have been leaning back against the tower quietly gloating, watching the dazzling white clouds move past. There is quite a breeze, but a soft, almost summery one. It is 6 weeks today since Topaz and I stood on Belmont in the dusk with life at its lowest ebb, though it ebbed a great deal lower afterwards. At first, only Topaz and I were miserable. It was a terrible strain not to show it. We used to slip off for long walks together and let our faces fall. Rose's exuberance lasted about 10 days, and then she began to feel something else ought to happen. I staved her off for another week by suggesting Mrs. Cotton's arrival must have kept her sons busy. Then the blow fell. Miss Marcy told us that the vicar had gone over to call and been asked to lunch, and that various Scotney people had been invited there. "But no one but the vicar from Godsend," I said hastily. "But there is no one else in Godsend they would ever ask except us." "Your turn's next, dear," said Miss Marcy. Rose got up and walked straight out of the kitchen. That night, after we were in bed, she suddenly said, "Ask Miss Blossom what went wrong, Cassandra." I was absolutely stuck. I felt I ought to edge in some advice for the future, but I couldn't see how without telling the brutal truth. "She says she doesn't know," I said at last. I didn't make Miss Blossom say it herself because I think of her as very sincere. "I expect it's because we're so poor," said Rose bitterly. Then she sat up in the iron bedstead. It was my week for the four-poster, and said, "I was nice to them. Really, I was." I saw my chance, and said in Miss Blossom's voice, "Perhaps you were too nice, dearie." "But I wasn't," said Rose. "I was charming, but I was, oh, capricious, contradictory. Isn't that what men like?" "You just be natural, girlie," said Miss Blossom. Then I went on in my own voice. "How much did you really like them, Rose?" "I don't know. But I know I don't like them now. Oh, I don't want to talk about it." And that was all she ever did talk about it. That was almost the worst part of the gloom, our not talking naturally. Never have I felt so separate from her. And I regret to say that there were moments when my deep and loving pity for her merged into a desire to kick her fairly hard. For she is a girl who cannot walk her troubles off, or work them off. She is a girl to sit around and glare. Topaz was wonderfully patient. But I sometimes wonder if it is not only patience, but also a faint resemblance to cows. It is rather like her imperviousness to cold. Father once said she had a plush-lined skin, and there are times when I think she has plush-lined feelings. But they certainly aren't plush-lined where Father himself is concerned. 3 weeks ago I found her crying in buffer state in front of her portrait of him, for which he never sits. It is mostly orange triangles. She said his disappointment was far more important than Rose's, that he had so much enjoyed meeting Simon Cotton and was longing to talk about the American essay on Jacob Wrestling. Particularly now he's changed his mind about it. He now thinks he did mean all the things the critic says he did. And I was sure it had started him writing. But I've just sneaked into the gatehouse while he's over at the vicarage. And what do you think he's working on? Crossword puzzles. I suggested there might be money in crossword puzzles. Not that kind, said Topaz. They didn't make sense. Cassandra, what is the matter with him? I had a most dreadful thought. I wondered if Father really had been drinking for years, if he had found a secret wine cellar under the castle, or was making drink out of something. I know there is some stuff called wood alcohol. Oh, don't be idiotic, said Topaz. You can tell if men are drinking. We must be patient. It's just that he's a genius. She went to bathe her eyes, and then put on her favourite dress, which is cream satin damask, Italian, just about dropping to pieces. She wears a little ruby red cap with it. Then she went down to make potato cakes for tea. I was in the garden, looking at a daffodil that was almost out, when Father came back from the vicarage. "Any news?" I called, to be friendly. "Only that it appears to be quite a distinction not to be asked to Scotney. I gather invitations are being broadcast." He said it in his loftiest manner, then gave me a quick little embarrassed smile and added, "I'm sorry, my child. You know what the trouble is, don't you?" I stared at him, and he went on, "It's the rent. They've looked into that little matter. I know, because the usual application didn't come in on the March quarter day. Oh, they're kind enough. The best type of American always is. But they don't want to get involved with us." I knew Topaz hadn't told him the truth, partly because she thought it would upset him, and partly because she has a sort of women-must-stick-together attitude. I wondered if I ought to tell him myself, and then I decided that if he did feel guilty about the rent, it would be a good thing. Anything. Anything to prod him into working. But as he stood there, in his thin old coat, with the March wind blowing his fading gold hair, I felt very sorry for him. So I told him there were potato cakes for tea. As it turned out, the potato cakes were spoilt, because while we were eating them, we had one of those family rows which are so funny in books and on the pictures. They aren't funny in real life, particularly when they happen at meals, as they so often do. They always make me shake and feel rather sick. The trouble arose because Thomas asked Rose to pass the salt 3 times, and she took no notice. And when he shouted at her, she leaned forward and boxed his ears. Topaz said, "Blast you, Rose. You know Thomas gets earache." And Rose said, "You would bring that up. I suppose he'll die and I'll be responsible." Father said, "Damnation!" and pushed his chair back onto Heloise, who yelped. And I said, "I can't stand it. I can't stand it," which was ridiculous. Stephen was the only person who kept calm. He got up quietly to see if Heloise was badly hurt. She wasn't, and she came off very well because we gave her most of the potato cakes. Our appetites came back later, when there was nothing worth eating. Food isn't much better, in spite of Stephen's wages coming in regularly, because we have to go slow until the tradesmen's bills are paid off. Stephen keeps back a shilling a week. This exercise book came out of his savings. I have an uneasy feeling he will spend most of them on me. He certainly spends nothing on himself. He hasn't brought me any poems lately, which is a relief. That evening of the row was our lowest depths. Miserable people cannot afford to dislike each other. Cruel blows of fate call for extreme kindness in the family circle. Had we but known it, our fortunes were already slightly on the mend. For that was the very day Father's Aunt Millicent died. How dreadfully callous I sound. But if I could bring her back to life, truly I would. And as I can't, there seems no harm in thanking God for his wondrous ways. For she left Rose and me her personal wardrobe, which means clothes. Not a piece of furniture, as I thought at first. When the vicar saw the death announced in the Times, we entertained a faint hope that she might have left Father some money. But she had cut him out of her will and left everything to a hostel for artists' models. I suppose she thought they ought to stick in hostels and not go marrying her relations. "Just think," said Rose, "if Father hadn't married Topaz, we might be rolling in wealth by now." And I asked myself if I would rather roll than have Topaz in the family, and decided I wouldn't, which was nice to know. After the first exuberance had worn off, we remembered that Aunt Millicent was 74 and an eccentric dresser. But to be left anything at all gives one a lift. The lawyers wrote asking us to come to London and pack the clothes ourselves. They said they would pay all expenses. The prospect of a day in London was heaven, but the problem of what to wear was sheer hell, particularly for Rose. My clothes don't bear thinking about, so I just don't think about them. We sponged and pressed our winter coats and tried to believe that they looked better. And then the weather turned fine. Those coats were utterly revolting in the brilliant sunshine. I had a sudden idea. "Let's wear our old white suits," I said. Aunt Millicent had them made for us just before the row about Father marrying Topaz. They are some kind of silky linen, very plain and tailored. Of course, they have had very hard wear, and mine is too short, though it has been let down to the last quarter inch. But they are much the nicest things we have, and by a miracle, had been put away clean. "They'd be all right if it was midsummer," said Rose, when we tried them on, "but in April." Still, we decided to wear them if the fine weather held. And when we woke up yesterday, it was more like June than April. Oh, it was the most glorious morning. I suppose the best kind of spring morning is the best weather God has to offer. It certainly helps one to believe in him. Mr. Stebbins lent Stephen his cart to drive us to the station, and even the horse seemed to be enjoying himself. "Did you ever see the sky so high?" I said. And then I felt ashamed to be so happy, knowing that I couldn't have been if Aunt Millicent had stayed alive. And it probably hurt her to die, poor old lady. We were driving through God's End, and the early morning sun was striking the moss-grown headstones in the churchyard. I tried to realise that I shall die myself one day. But I couldn't believe it. And then I had a flash that when it really happens, I shall remember that moment and see again the high Suffolk sky over the old, old God's End graves. Thinking of death, strange, beautiful, terrible and a long way off, made me feel happier than ever. The only depressing thing was seeing Scotney Hall through the trees, and that only dampened me on Rose's account. For what care I for cottons? Anyway, What cared I then? I was careful to avoid her eye until we were well past the park, spending 2 tactful minutes buttoning a 1-button shoe. We got to Scotney Station in good time. Rose thought we should take first-class tickets as the lawyers would pay. But suppose they don't pay us at once, I said. We had Stephen's wages to see us through the day, but Topaz was counting on getting them back. In the end, we just took cheap day tickets. Stephen kept begging me to be careful of the traffic. He even ran along with the train to remind me again. Then he stood, waving, smiling, but a bit wistful-looking. It struck me that never in his life has he been to London. It was queer how different things felt after we changed from our little toy train at King's Crypt. The feel of the country went. It was as if the London air was trapped in the London train, and our white suits began to look peculiar. They looked much, much more peculiar when we got to London. People really stared at us. Rose noticed it at once. "It's because they admire our suits," I said, hoping to soothe her. And I did think they looked nicer than most of the drab clothes women were wearing. "We look conspicuous," she said, with deepest shame. Little did she know how much more conspicuous we should look before we got home. It was 3 years since we had been in London. We never knew it well, of course. Yesterday was the first time I ever walked through the city. It was fascinating, especially the stationer's shops. I could look at stationer's shops for ever and ever. Rose says they are the dullest shops in the world, except, perhaps, butchers. I don't see how you can call butchers' shops dull. They are too full of horror. We kept getting lost and having to ask policemen, who were all rather playful and fatherly. One of them kindly held up the traffic for us, and a taxi driver made kissing noises at Rose. I had hoped the lawyer's office would be old and dark, with a Dickensy old lawyer, but it was just an ordinary office, and we only saw a clerk who was young with very sleek hair. He asked us if we could find our way to Chelsea by bus. "No," said Rose quickly. He said, "Okay, take a taxi." I said we were a little short of change. Rose flushed scarlet. He gave her a quick look, then said, "Wait a sec," and left us. He came back with £4. "Mr. Stevenage says you're to have this," he told us. "It'll take care of your fares, taxi to Chelsea, taxi to get the stuff to the station, and a slap-up lunch. And you must nip back here with the key of the house and sign a receipt. See?" We said we saw, and went. Rose was furious that no one more important than a clerk had bothered to see us. "It's not respectful to Aunt Millicent," she said indignantly, "treating us like small fry." I didn't mind what kind of fry I was, with £4 in hand. "Let's find our way by bus and save the taxi money," I suggested. But she said she couldn't stand being stared at any more. "We must be the only girls in London wearing white." Just then, a bus conductor said, "Up on, Snowdrops!" She haughtily hailed a taxi. The lily pond was dry in Aunt Millicent's little flagged garden. I hoped the goldfish had found good homes. We unlocked the front door. I was surprised to find the hall quite bare. I hadn't realised that all the furniture had been taken away. "It does feel queer," I said when the door was closed and the sunny day shut out. "It only feels cold," said Rose. "I suppose the clothes will be in her bedroom. I wonder if she died there." I thought it a tactless thing to wonder out loud. On our way up, we looked in at the double drawing room. The 2 tall windows stared across the Thames. It was dazzlingly light. The last time I'd seen that room, it had been lit by dozens of candles for a party. That was the night we first met Topaz. MacMorris's portrait of her had just been exhibited, and Aunt Millicent asked him to bring her with him. She wore the misty blue dress he painted her in, and he had lent her the great jade necklace. I remember being astonished at the long, pale hair hanging down her back. And I remember Father talking to her all evening, and Aunt Millicent in her black velvet suit and lace stock glaring at him. There was nothing in the big front bedroom, much to my relief, though I can't say it felt as if anyone had died there, merely cold and empty. The clothes were in the little back dressing room lying in heaps on the floor, with 2 old black leather trunks for us to pack them in. There was very little light because the green Venetian blind was down. The cord was broken so we couldn't get it up, but we managed to tilt the slats a little. Aunt Millicent's old black military cloak lay on top of one of the heaps. It used to frighten me when I was little. I suppose it made me think of witches. It was frightening yesterday, too, but in a different way. It seemed somehow to be part of a dead person. All the clothes did. I said, Rose, I don't think I can touch them.
We've got to, she said, and started to rummage through them.
Perhaps if we had ever been fond of poor Aunt Millicent, we might have felt a kindness for her clothes. Perhaps if they had been pretty and feminine, it wouldn't have been so horrible. But they were mostly heavy, dark coats and skirts and thick woolen underwear, and rows of flat-heeled shoes on wooden trees, which upset me most of all. I kept thinking of them as dead feet.
There are dozens of linen handkerchiefs, that's something, said Rose.
But I hated the handkerchiefs, and the gloves, and the stockings, and a dreadful pair of broken-looking corsets. People's clothes ought to be buried with them, I said. They oughtn't to be left behind to be despised.
I'm not despising them, said Rose. Some of these suits are made of wonderful cloth.
But she was bundling them into the trunks in a somehow insulting way. I made myself take them out and fold them carefully, and had a mental picture of Aunt Millicent looking relieved. She always liked her suits to be well pressed and brushed, I said.
As if it mattered to her now, said Rose.
And then we heard someone coming upstairs. I went icy cold from my heart up to my shoulders. Then the fear got into my throat so that I couldn't speak. I just stared at Rose in agony.
It isn't. It isn't, she gasped. Oh, Cassandra, it isn't.
But I knew that she thought it was. And I knew, in the way I so often know things about Rose, that she had been frightened ever since we entered the house, that the casual way she handled the clothes had been all bluff. But I didn't know then that she was doubly frightened, that she thought if it wasn't Aunt Millicent coming up the stairs, it was a tramp who had been hiding in the basement, that he would kill us both and put our bodies in the trunks.
Oh, wonderful Rose!
With both these fears in her mind, she flung open the door and said, Who's there? The lawyer's clerk stood outside.
How dare you! How dare you! She cried furiously, sneaking into the house, terrifying my little sister.
Don't, Rose, I said in a weak voice. The poor clerk apologized profusely. And I only came to do you a good turn, he finished. Then he handed her a letter. Rose read it.
But we can't pay this.
I snatched it from her. It was a reminder that money was owing for the cold storage of some furs.
You don't have to pay anything. I fixed that by telephone, said the clerk. We're your aunt's executors, so we get her bills, see?
That was actually on my desk when you came in this morning, but I hadn't got round to reading it. Those are your furs now.
But Aunt Millicent never had any furs, I said.
She thought they were cruel to animals,
and I always thought she was right.
Well, those belonged to her, said the clerk. And cruel or not, you'd better pop along and get them. Furs are worth money. I looked at the letter again. It didn't say what the furs were.
They must be good ones, if she paid out all that to store them, said the clerk.
Tell you what, you shove all this stuff in the trunks, and I'll take them down to the station. Leave them in the left luggage office for you, see? And you cut along for the furs. We bundled the clothes in hurriedly. I am ashamed to say I forgot about Aunt Millicent's dead feelings. The clerk and the taxi driver dragged the trunks downstairs. Then he got another taxi for us.
Wish I could come with you and see the fun, he said, but I'm due in the courts at 3.
His hair was oily and his complexion spotty, but his heart was kind. Rose evidently thought so too, because she leaned out of the taxi and said she was sorry she had been so cross.
Don't mention it, he said. I'm sure I'd have given myself a fright if I'd been you.
Then the taxi started, and he shouted after us.
Here's hoping they're sables.
We hoped so too.
They must be fairly new, as she didn't have them when we knew her, said Rose.
I expect her principles dwindled as she got older and colder. They'll probably be rabbit, I said, feeling I ought to damp our imaginings. But I didn't really believe Aunt Millicent would have worn anything cheap.
The taxi drew up at a wonderful shop, the sort of shop I would never dare to walk through without a reason. We went in by way of the glove and stocking department, but there were things from other departments just dotted about, bottles of scent, and a little glass tree with cherries on it, and a piece of white branched coral on a sea-green chiffon scarf. Oh, it was an artful place. It must make people who have money want to spend it madly. The pale grey carpets were as springy as moss, and the air was scented. It smelt a bit like bluebells, but richer, deeper. "What does it smell of exactly?" I said, and Rose said, "Heaven." There was a different scent in the fur department, heavier, and the furs themselves had an exciting smell. There were lots of them lying about on the grey satin sofas, deep brown, golden brown, silvery. And there was a young, fair mannequin walking about in an ermine cape over a pink gauze dress with a little muff. A woman with blue-white hair came and asked if she could help us and took away our storage bill. And after a while, two men in white coats came in with Aunt Millicent's furs and dumped them on a sofa. We shook them out and examined them. There were two very long coats, one of them black and shaggy, and the other smoothish and brown. A short, black, tight-fitting jacket with leg-o'-mutton sleeves, and a large, hairy rug with a green felt border. "But whatever animals were they?" I gasped. The white-haired woman inspected them gingerly. She said the brown coat was beaver, and the short jacket, which had a rusty look under its black, was sealskin. She couldn't identify the rug at all. It looked like collie dog to me. Rose tried the long, shaggy black coat on. It reached to the ground. "You look like a bear," I said. "It is bear," said the white-haired woman. "Dear me, I think it must have been a coachman's coat." "There's something in the pocket," said Rose. She drew out a piece of paper. On it was scrawled, "Meet Madam's train, 1:20. Miss Millie to dancing class at 3. The young ladies to the Grange at 6. I worked out. Aunt Millicent was father's father's youngest sister. These furs must have been her mother's. That made them... Heavens! I cried. These belong to our great-grandmother. A sort of manager person came and talked to us. We asked him if there was anything valuable. "You couldn't get the beaver today for love or money," he said. "But I don't know if you can sell it for much. We treat fur so differently now. It weighs a ton." The shop didn't buy second-hand furs, and he couldn't advise us where to take them. We felt that London was the most likely place to sell them in, and wanted to leave them until we could get advice from Topaz. But he said that if they stayed any longer, they would run into another quarter's storage charges, and Aunt Millicent's lawyers probably wouldn't pay any more. So we said we would take them over our arms. It seemed the only way. We signed things, and then loaded up. On the way out, we looked through the archway into the department we had come in by. There was a woman buying pale blue suede gloves. She wore the plainest little black suit, but Rose thought she looked wonderful. "That's how we ought to dress," she said. We stood there, staring at the scent and stockings and things. We saw one woman buy a dozen pairs of silk stockings, until I said, "We're like Ab when he sees birds fly past the window. At any moment, we'll let out wistful cat noises." Rose said she felt just like that. "Well, let's walk round the whole shop while we're in it," I suggested. But she said she couldn't bear to, loaded up with furs. So I put my head through the archway and took one big sniff of the bluebell scent, and then we went out of the main door, which was close at hand. Rose wanted to take the furs straight back to the city by taxi, but there wasn't one to be seen. And I was so ravenous that I persuaded her we ought to have something to eat first. We tottered to Oxford Street. Those furs certainly did weigh tons, and found a place with nice white tablecloths and great round cruets. It was a bit of a business getting ourselves settled. We tried folding the furs and sitting on them, but then we found we could reach neither the floor nor our plates. In the end, we had to dump everything down beside us, which was rather unpopular with the waitress. But I did like the restaurant. Most of the people eating there were unusually ugly, but the food was splendid. We had roast chicken, wing portion, 2 shillings, double portions of bread sauce, each, 2 vegetables, treacle pudding and wonderful milky coffee. We were gloriously bloat.
By the time we finished, it was getting on for 4 o'clock.
"We've seen hardly anything of London," I said, as we drove back to the lawyer's.
Rose said she wouldn't have wanted to, even if we hadn't been burdened with the furs, because it was no fun being in London in the wrong clothes.
After that, she was quiet so long that I asked her what she was thinking about.
"I was willing God to give me a little black suit," she said.
Our friend, the clerk, laughed his head off at the furs, but he said it was a damn shame. He thought the beaver must have been a man's travelling coat. It was too big for him, even. And that the beaver was the lining, and the Scotch plaid was the right side. He gave us cups of tea and 2 squash fly biscuits each, but we were too full to eat them, so we put them in an envelope for the journey. When we got the old leather trunks from the left luggage office, the man asked if there were any bodies in them. It was then Rose told me how she had feared that there might have been. Ours.
We had a compartment to ourselves on the train, and as it turned cold after sunset, I put on the beaver coat, fur side inwards. It felt wonderfully friendly. It was extraordinary. I had the most affectionate feelings for all those furs, no horror of them at all, as I had of Aunt Millicent's clothes, though I knew they must all have been worn by dead people. I thought about it a lot, getting warmer and warmer in the beaver, and I decided that it was like the difference between the beautiful old God's End graves and the new ones open to receive coffins, which I never can bear to look at. That time takes the ugliness and horror out of death and turns it into beauty. 1 year ago, I would have made a poem out of that idea. I tried to, yesterday, but it wasn't any use. Oh, I could think of lines that rhymed and scanned, but that is all they were. I know now that is all my poems ever were. Yet I used to feel I could leap over the moon when I'd made one up. I miss that, rather. I leaned back and closed my eyes, and instantly the whole day danced before me. I wasn't merely remembering. It seemed to be trapped inside my eyelids. The city, the traffic, the shops were all there, shimmering, merging. Then my brain began to pick out the bits it wanted to think about, and I realized how the day made a pattern of clothes. First our white dresses in the early morning, then the consciousness of what people were wearing in London, then Aunt Millicent's poor dead clothes, then all the exquisite things in the shop, then our furs. And I thought how important clothes were to women, and always had been. I thought of Norman ladies in Belmont Tower Keep, and Plantagenet ladies living in God's Inn Castle, and Stuart ladies when our house was built on the ruins, and hoops, and Jane Austen dresses, and crinolines, and bustles, and Rose longing for a little black suit. I had the most profound, philosophic thoughts about it all. But perhaps I dreamt them, for they all seemed to have floated away. When Rose woke me, I was dreaming of the white-branched coral on the sea-green chiffon scarf. It was time to change trains. I felt frozen when I took the beaver coat off. I thought I'd better because it not only looked peculiar, but trailed on the ground. I was thankful when we were in our little branch line train and I could put it on again. Rose put on the coachman's coat, and we each leaned out of a window to smell the sweet country smell. You don't notice it unless you've been away. We still had our squashed fly biscuits, so we ate them, leaning out into the night. Only I saved one of mine for Stephen, who was to meet us with Mr. Stebbins's cart to take the trunks. And then it happened. As we stopped at Little Limping, I looked towards the guard's van to make sure our trunks didn't get pulled out by mistake. The station master is a bit daft. And there, looking out of the train, not 6 yards away from me, was Simon Cotton. His hair and beard looked very black. The sickly light from the platform lamps made him seem very pale, and even in that quick glance I noticed the naked look of his mouth. I dodged back and yelled to Rose. I reckoned we had 10 minutes to think in. We were 5 miles from Scotney and the little train crawls. But oh, I needed more time. I couldn't make up my mind if I ought to tell Rose what the Cottons had said about her. I was so frightened that if I didn't, she might be silly again. "Let's be distant with them," I said, while I tidied my hair in the glass between photographs of Norwich Cathedral and Yarmouth Beach. "Distant? Do you think I intend to speak to them, after they've ignored us? But we'll have to say good evening, won't we? We can say it coldly and sweep on with dignity." She said we couldn't do anything with dignity dressed as we were, and laden with furs like hearth rugs. She wanted us to jump out of the train as it stopped, and dash away before the Cottons saw us.
But we can't dash away without our trunks, I said. Then I had an idea. We'll get out on the wrong side of the train and walk along the line to the guard's van. By the time we get there, the Cottons will be out of the station. She thought it would work. We decided to keep the fur coats on so that we should be invisible in the darkness at the end of the platform if the Cottons looked back while we were getting the trunks. Rose turned up the huge bearskin collar to hide her bright hair. Let's hope no train comes on the other line while we're walking along, I said. But I knew it was unlikely at that time of night, and they would come very slowly. Anyway, we could push these little trains back with one hand, said Rose. I hoisted the collie dog rug over my shoulder. Rose took the sealskin jacket. The instant the train stopped, we jumped down onto the line. We hadn't realized how difficult walking would be. The coats were so awkward to hold up, and we kept tripping over things. The paraffin lamps on the platform gave a very weak light, and there were no lamps at all so far along as the guard's van. We couldn't reach the doors on our side, so we went round the back of the train and climbed up onto the platform. The doors of the van were open that side, but there appeared to be no guard to put the trunks off. The station master usually helps with luggage, but he is the ticket collector too, and I was sure he would be busy seeing the Cottons off. We must manage by ourselves, I said. The van was so dimly lit that at first we couldn't see the trunks. Then Rose spotted them at the far end behind a lot of tall milk cans. As we went over, we passed a big crate. The feeble little gas mantle was just above it, and I saw on the label, Cotton, Scotney, Suffolk. Rose saw it too, and gave a gasp. The next second we heard voices and steps coming along the platform. We rushed to the doorway, then realized it was too late to get out. Quick, get behind the trunks, said Rose. If I'd had time to think, I might have reasoned with her, told her we should look such fools if we were discovered. But she bolted to the trunks, and I bolted too. They'll never see us, she said, as we crouched down. I didn't think they would either. The trunks were high, and the light was so weak and so far away from us. But crouch lower, I whispered. Your trunk's not as high as mine. Oh, we'll manage between us, sir, said a man's voice. It wasn't the station master's, so I guessed it was the guard come back. I'll help, said Neil Cotton, jumping into the van. Then he shouted, My guard! And jumped out again. The next instant the doors crashed together with such violence that the gas mantle broke, leaving us in blackness. What is it? What's the matter? Shouted Simon Cotton. I couldn't hear what Neil answered, but I heard the guard give a roar of laughter and say, Well, that's a good one, that is. Oh, Rose, he saw us, I whispered. Rubbish. Why would he slam the doors on us? She whispered back. No, it's something else. Shut up. Listen. I raised my head cautiously. I could just see the outline of the window, a little open at the top. I heard Simon Cotton say, Neil, you're crazy. I tell you, I'm certain. Oh, come, sir. I've been sitting in that van, said the guard. But you left the doors open. I saw a faint blur moving in the darkness. It was Rose's face coming up from behind her trunk. What is it? She whispered desperately. Shh, I said, straining my ears. I think I shall remember that minute as long as I live. The stars in the square of window, the bead of light above the broken mantle, the smell of stale milk and fish. I heard Simon Cotton say he would get a flashlight from the car. And tell Mother to stay inside with the door shut, Neil called after him. Rose began to crawl towards the window. There was a hollow clang. She had collided with a milk can. The guard gave a low whistle. Sounds like you're right, sir. Of course I'm right, said Neil. Haven't I fed them in Yellowstone Park? And then it dawned on me. Rose, I said, you've been mistaken for a bear. I heard her gasp, The idiot! The idiot! Then she clanged into another milk can. Well, 7/8 of you is a bear. And the circus is at King's Crypt. The tents were close to the railway line. The Cottons couldn't have missed seeing them. I began to laugh, but stopped when I heard her struggling with the doors on the far side of the van. She got them open, and I saw her black against the stars. Come on, quick, she said, as she jumped down onto the line. I got across to the doorway, and every milk can clanged into the one next to it. Above the din, I could hear Neil Cotton and the guard running along the platform and shouting to the engine driver.
"Oh, Rose, don't be a fool," I cried. "We'll have to explain."
She grabbed my hands and pulled until I had to jump.
"If you don't come with me, I'll never forgive you," she whispered fiercely. "I'd die rather than explain."
"Then you quite probably will die, because lots of people in the country have guns handy." But it was no use. She had vanished into the darkness at the back of the train. Passengers were shouting and banging doors. There couldn't have been many of them, but they were making a devil of a noise. Fortunately, they were concentrating on the platform side of the train. It suddenly came to me that if I could make Rose take her coat off, we could join in the pursuit as if we had no connection with the bear. So I struggled out of my own coat, flung it up into the van, and started after her. But before I had gone a couple of yards, the beam of a torch shone out. I saw Rose clearly. She had got beyond the end of the platform and was scrambling up the little embankment, and as she was on all fours, she really did look exactly like a bear. There was a wild shout from the people on the platform. Rose topped the embankment and disappeared over into the fields.
"Fox Earth Farms over there," shouted a woman. "They've got three little children."
I heard someone running along the platform. The woman yelled,
"Quick, quick, over to Fox Earth."
There was a thump as someone jumped down onto the line. Then Stephen crossed the beam of the torch. The light gleamed on metal, and I realized that he was carrying a pitchfork. It must have been in Mr. Stebbins' cart.
"Stop, Stephen, stop," I screamed.
He turned and shouted,
"I won't hurt it unless I have to, Miss Cassandra. I'll head it into a barn."
Neil Cotton went past me.
"Here, give me that," he said,
grabbing Stephen's pitchfork. Simon came running along, shooting his torch ahead of him. The guard and some of the passengers came pounding after him, and somebody crashed into me and knocked me over. The torch began to flicker on and off. Simon thumped it, and then it went out altogether.
"Get the station lanterns," shouted the guard, scrambling back onto the platform.
The passengers waited for him, but Simon and Stephen went on after Neil into the darkness. Perhaps I ought to have explained at once. But what with the noise and being knocked down, I was a bit dazed, and I knew how ghastly it would be for Rose. Not only the Cottons knowing, but all the local people on the train, and I did think she had a good chance to get away. "Anyway, Neil will see she's not a bear if he gets close to her," I told myself. Then they all came thudding past with the lanterns, and the station master had his great black dog on a chain and a stone in his hand. I knew it wasn't safe to keep quiet any longer. I started to tell them, but the dog was barking so loudly that nobody heard me. And then, high above everything, I heard the most piercing shriek. I lost my head completely.
"It's my sister," I screamed. "He's killing her."
And I dashed off along the line. They all came after me, shouting, and someone fell over the dog's chain and cursed extensively. We climbed over the embankment into the field, and the men held the lanterns high, but we couldn't see Rose or the Cottons or Stephen. Everyone was talking at once, making suggestions. There was a fat woman who wanted the station master to let his dog off its chain, but he was afraid it might bite the Cottons instead of the bear.
"But it'll hug them to death," moaned the fat woman. "They won't have a chance."
I opened my mouth to make them understand that there wasn't any bear, and then I saw something white in the distance. The men with the lanterns saw it too, and ran towards it. And suddenly Neil Cotton walked into the light, carrying Rose in her white suit. Simon Cotton and Stephen were a few steps behind. The fat woman hurried forward.
"Stand back, please," said Neil Cotton firmly. "She's had a dreadful shock." "Rose! Rose!" I cried, running to her.
"She's all right," said Simon Cotton quickly. "But we want to get her to our car." He grabbed one of the lanterns, lit the way for Neil, and they walked stolidly on.
"But the bear, sir," said the guard.
"Dead," said Simon Cotton. "My brother killed it."
"Are you sure, sir?" said the station master.
"We'd better have a look," said the fat woman. "The dog'll soon find it."
"No, it won't," said Neil Cotton, over his shoulder. "It fell in the river and was carried away by the current."
"Poor thing! Poor thing, it didn't have a chance," wailed the fat woman. "Killed first and drowned afterwards, and I dare say it was valuable."
"You go with your sister," Simon Cotton told me, and I was only too glad to. He handed the lantern to Stephen and